Chapter 21 The Furnace of Civil War 1861-1865 My paramount object in the struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or to destroy slavery. Abraham Lincoln, 1862 When President Lincoln issued his call to the states for 75,000 militiamen on April 15, 1861, he envisioned them serving for only 90 days. Reaffirming his limited war aims, he declared that he had no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with slavery in the states where it exists. With a swift flourish of federal force, he hoped to show the folly of secession and rapidly return the rebellious states to the Union. But the war was to be neither brief nor limited. When the guns fell silent 4 years later, hundreds of thousands of soldiers on both sides lay dead, slavery was ended forever, and the nation faced the challenge of reintegrating the defeated but still recalcitrant South into the Union. Bull Run ends the 90-day war. Northern newspapers, at first sharing Lincoln's expectation of a quick victory, raised the cry, "On to Richmond." In this yeasty atmosphere, a Union army of some 30,000 men drilled near Washington in the summer of 1861. It was ill-prepared for battle, but the press and the public clamored for action. Lincoln eventually concluded that an attack on a smaller Confederate force at Bull Run Manassas Junction, some 30 miles southwest of Washington, might be worth a try. If successful, it would demonstrate the superiority of Union arms. It might even lead to the capture of the Confederate capital at Richmond, 100 miles to the south. If Richmond fell, secession would be sorely discredited, and the Union could be restored without damage to the economic and social system of the South. Raw Yankee recruits swaggered out of Washington toward Bull Run on July 21, 1861, as if they were headed for a sporting event. Congressmen and spectators trailed along with their lunch baskets to witness the fun. At first the battle went well for the Yankees. But Stonewall Jackson's gray-clad warrior stood like a stone wall. Here he won his nickname, and Confederate reinforcements arrived unexpectedly. Panic seized the green Union troops, many of whom fled in shameful confusion. The Confederates, themselves too exhausted or disorganized to pursue, feasted on captured lunches. The military picnic at Bull Run, though not decisive militarily, bore significant psychological and political consequences, many of them paradoxical. Victory was worse than defeat for the South, because it inflated an already dangerous overconfidence. Many of the Southern soldiers promptly deserted, some boastfully to display their trophies, others feeling that the war was now surely over. Southern enlistments fell off sharply, and preparations for a protracted conflict slackened. Defeat was better than victory for the Union, because it dispelled all illusions of a one-punch war and caused the Northerners to buckle down to the staggering task at hand. It also set the stage for a war that would be waged not merely for the cause of Union but also, eventually, for the abolitionist ideal of emancipation. Tardy George M. C. McClellan and the Peninsula Campaign. Northern hopes brightened later in 1861, when General George B. M. C. McClellan was given command of the Army of the Potomac, as a major Union force near Washington was now called. Red-haired and red-mustached, strong and stocky, M. C. McClellan was a brilliant, 34-year-old West Pointer. As a serious student of warfare who was dubbed Young Napoleon, he had seen plenty of fighting, first in the Mexican War and then as an observer of the Crimean War in Russia. Cocky George M. C. McClellan embodied a curious mixture of virtues and defects. He was a superb organizer and drillmaster, and he injected splendid morale into the Army of the Potomac. Hating to sacrifice his troops, he was idolized by his men, who affectionately called him Little Mac. But he was a perfectionist who seems not to have realized that an army is never ready to the last button and that wars cannot be won without running some risks. He consistently but erroneously believed that the enemy outnumbered him, partly because his intelligence reports from the head of Pinkerton's detective agency were unreliable. He was overcautious. Lincoln once accused him of having the slows, and he addressed the president in an arrogant tone that a less forgiving person would never have tolerated. Privately, the general referred to his chief as a baboon. As M. C. McClellan doggedly continued to drill his army without moving it toward Richmond, the derisive northern watchword became "All quiet along the Potomac." The song of the hour was Tardy George M. C. McClellan. After threatening to borrow the army if it was not going to be used, Lincoln finally issued firm orders to advance. A reluctant McClellan at last decided upon the waterborne approach to Richmond, which lies at the western base of a narrow peninsula formed by the James and York Rivers, hence the name given to this historic encounter, the Peninsula Campaign. McClellan wearily inched toward the Confederate capital in the spring of 1862 with about 100,000 men after taking a month to capture historic Yorktown, which bristled with imitation wooden cannon. He finally came within sight of the spires of Richmond. At this crucial juncture, Lincoln diverted McClellan's anticipated reinforcements to chase Stonewall Jackson, whose lightning feints in the Shenandoah Valley seemed to put Washington, D.C., in jeopardy. Stalled in front of Richmond, McClellan was further frustrated when Jeff Stuart's Confederate cavalry rode completely around his army on reconnaissance. Then General Robert E. Lee launched a devastating counterattack, the 7 days' battles June 26, July 2, 1862. The Confederates slowly drove McClellan back to the sea. The Union forces abandoned the Peninsula Campaign as a costly failure, and Lincoln temporarily abandoned McClellan as commander of the Army of the Potomac, though Lee's army had suffered some 20,000 casualties to McClellan's 10,000. Lee had achieved a brilliant, if bloody, triumph. Yet the ironies of his accomplishment are striking. If McClellan had succeeded in taking Richmond and ending the war in mid-1862, the Union would probably have been restored with minimal disruption to the peculiar institution. Slavery would have survived, at least for a time. By a successful defense of Richmond and defeat of McClellan, Lee had in effect ensured that the war would endure until slavery was uprooted and the Old South thoroughly destroyed. Lincoln himself, who had earlier professed his unwillingness to tamper with slavery where it already existed, now declared that the rebels cannot experiment for 10 years trying to destroy the government, and if they fail still come back into the Union unhurt. He began to draft an Emancipation Proclamation. Union strategy now turned toward total war. As finally developed, the Northern military plan had 6 components. First, slowly suffocate the South by blockading its coasts. Second, liberate the slaves and hence undermine the very economic foundations of the Old South. Third, cut the Confederacy in half by seizing control of the Mississippi River backbone. Fourth, chop the Confederacy to pieces by sending troops through Georgia and the Carolinas. Fifth, decapitate it by capturing its capital at Richmond. And sixth, this was Ulysses Grant's idea especially, try everywhere to engage the enemy's main strength and to grind it into submission. The war at sea, the blockade started leakily. It was not clamped down all at once but was extended by degrees. A watertight patrol of some 3,500 miles of coast was impossible for the hastily improvised Northern Navy, which counted converted yachts and ferry boats in its fleet. But blockading was simplified by concentrating on the principal ports and inlets where dock facilities were available for loading bulky bales of cotton. How was the blockade regarded by the naval powers of the world? Ordinarily, they probably would have defied it, for it was never completely effective and was especially civ-like at the outset. But Britain, the greatest maritime nation, recognized it as binding and warned its shippers that they ignored it at their peril. An explanation is easy. Blockade happened to be the chief offensive weapon of Britain, which was still mistress of the seas. Britain plainly did not want to tie its hands in a future war by insisting that Lincoln maintain impossibly high blockading standards. Blockade running soon became riskily profitable, as the growing scarcity of southern goods drove prices skyward. The most successful blockade runners were swift, gray-painted steamers, scores of which were specially built in Scotland. A leading rendezvous was the West Indies port of Nassau, in the British Bahamas, where at one time 35 of the speediest ships rode at anchor. The low-lying craft would take on cargoes of arms brought in by tramp steamers from Britain, leave with fraudulent papers for Halifax, Canada, and then return a few days later with a cargo of cotton. The risks were great, but the profits would mount to 700% and more for lucky gamblers. 2 successful voyages might well pay for capture on a third. The lush days of blockade running finally passed as Union squadrons gradually pinched off the leading southern ports, from New Orleans to Charleston. The Northern Navy enforced the blockade with high-handed practices. Yankee captains, for example, would seize British freighters on the high seas, if laden with war supplies for the tiny port of Nassau and other halfway stations. The justification was that obviously these shipments were ultimately destined, by devious routes, for the Confederacy. London, although not happy, acquiesced in this disagreeable doctrine of ultimate destination or continuous voyage. British blockaders might need to take advantage of the same far-fetched interpretation in a future war as in fact they did in the World War of 1914-1918. The most alarming Confederate threat to the blockade came in 1862. Resourceful Southerners reefed and reconditioned the former wooden U.S. warship, the Merrimack, inflated its sides with old iron railroad rails, renamed the Virginia. This clumsy but powerful monster easily destroyed two wooden ships of the Union Navy in the Virginia waters of Chesapeake Bay. It also threatened catastrophe to the entire Yankee blockading fleet. Actually, the homemade ironclad was not a seaworthy craft. A tiny Union ironclad, the Monitor, built in about 100 days, arrived on the scene in the nick of time. For 4 hours, on March 9, 1862, the little Yankee cheesebox on a raft fought the wheezy Merrimack to a standstill. Britain and France had already built several powerful ironclads, but the first battle testing of these new craft heralded the doom of wooden warships. A few months after the historic battle, the Confederates destroyed the Merrimack to keep it from the grasp of advancing Union troops. The pivotal point on Tatum Robert E. Lee, having broken the back of McClellan's assault on Richmond, next moved northward. At the Second Battle of Bull Run August 29-30, 1862, he encountered a Federal force under General John Pope. A handsome, dashing, soldierly figure, Pope boasted that in the Western Theater of War, from which he had recently come, he had seen only the backs of the enemy. Lee quickly gave him a front view, furiously attacking Pope's troops and inflicting a crushing defeat. Emboldened by the success, Lee daringly thrust into Maryland. He hoped to strike a blow that would not only encourage foreign intervention but also seduce a still wavering border state and its sisters from the Union. The Confederate troops sang lustily, "Thou wilt not cower in the dust, Maryland. My Maryland. Thy gleaming sword shall never rust, Maryland. My Maryland." But the Marylanders did not respond to the siren song. The presence among the invaders of so many blanketless, hatless, and shoeless soldiers dampened the state's ardor. Events finally converged toward a critical battle at Antietam Creek, Maryland. Lincoln, yielding to popular pressure, hastily restored Little Mac to active command of the main Northern Army. His soldiers tossed their caps skyward and hugged his horse as they hailed his return. Fortune shone upon McClellan when two Union soldiers found a copy of Lee's battle plans wrapped around a packet of three cigars dropped by a careless Confederate officer. With this crucial piece of intelligence in hand, McClellan succeeded in halting Lee at Antietam on September 17, 1862, in one of the bitterest and bloodiest days of the war. Antietam was more or less a draw militarily. But Lee, finding his thrust parried, retired across the Potomac. McClellan, from whom much more had been hoped, was removed from his field command for the second and final time. His numerous critics, condemning him for not having boldly pursued the ever-dangerous Lee, finally got his scalp. The landmark Battle of Antietam was one of the decisive engagements of world history, probably the most decisive of the Civil War. Jefferson Davis was perhaps never again so near victory as on that fateful summer day. The British and French governments were on the verge of diplomatic mediation, a form of interference sure to be angrily resented by the North. An almost certain rebuff by Washington might well have spurred Paris and London into armed collusion with Richmond. But both capitals cooled off when the Union displayed unexpected power at Antietam, and their chill deepened with the passing months. Bloody Antietam was also the long-awaited victory that Lincoln needed for launching his Emancipation Proclamation. The abolitionists had long been clamoring for action when Wendell Phillips was denouncing the president as a first-rate, second-rate man. By midsummer of 1862, with the border states safely in the fold, Lincoln was ready to move. But he believed that to issue such an edict on the heels of a series of military disasters would be folly. It would seem like a confession that the North, unable to conquer the South, was forced to call upon the slaves to murder their masters. Lincoln therefore decided to wait for the outcome of Lee's invasion. Antietam served as a needed emancipation springboard. The halting of Lee's offensive was just enough of a victory to justify Lincoln's issuing, On September 23, 1862, the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. This oath-giving document announced that on January 1, 1863, the President would issue a final proclamation. On the scheduled date, he fully redeemed his promise, and the Civil War became more of a moral crusade as the fate of slavery and the South it had sustained was sealed. The war now became more of what Lincoln called a remorseless revolutionary struggle. After January 1, 1863, Lincoln said, "The character of the war will be changed. It will be one of subjugation. The old South is to be destroyed and replaced by new propositions and ideas." A proclamation without emancipation. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 declared forever free the slaves in those Confederate states still in rebellion. Bondsmen in the loyal border states were not affected, nor were those in specific conquered areas in the South. All told, about 800,000. The tone of the document was dull and legalistic. One historian has said that it had all the moral grandeur of a bill of lading. But if Lincoln stopped short of a clarion call for a holy war to achieve freedom, he pointedly concluded his historic document by declaring that the proclamation was an act of justice, and calling for the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God. The presidential pen did not formally strike the shackles from a single slave. Where Lincoln could presumably free the slave, that is, in the loyal border states, he refused to do so, lest he spur disunion. Where he could not, that is, in the Confederate states, he tried to. In short, where he could, he would not, and where he would, he could not. Thus the Emancipation Proclamation was stronger on proclamation than emancipation. Yet much unofficial do-it-yourself liberation did take place. Thousands of jubilant slaves, learning of the proclamation, flocked to the invading Union armies, stripping already run-down plantations of their workforce. In this sense, the Emancipation Proclamation was heralded by the drumbeat of running feet. But many fugitives would have come anyhow, as they had from the war's outset. Lincoln's immediate goal was not only to liberate the slaves but also to strengthen the moral cause of the Union at home and abroad. This he succeeded in doing. At the same time, Lincoln's proclamation clearly foreshadowed the ultimate doom of slavery. This was legally achieved by action of the individual states and by their ratification of the 13th Amendment in 1865, 8 months after the Civil War had ended. For text, see the appendix. The Emancipation Proclamation also fundamentally changed the nature of the war because it effectively removed any chance of a negotiated settlement. Both sides now knew that the war would be a fight to the finish. Public reactions to the long-awaited proclamation of 1863 were varied. "God Bless Abraham Lincoln," exulted the anti-slavery editor Horace Greeley in his New York Tribune. But many ardent abolitionists complained that Lincoln had not gone far enough. On the other hand, formidable numbers of Northerners, especially in the butternut regions of the Old Northwest and the border states, felt that he had gone too far. A cynical Democratic rhymester quipped, "Honest old Abe, when the war first began, denied abolition was part of his plan. Honest old Abe has since made a decree, the war must go on till the slaves are all free. As both can't be honest, will someone tell how? If honest Abe then, he is honest Abe now?" Opposition mounted in the North against supporting an abolition war. Ex-President Pierce and others felt that emancipation should not be inflicted on the slaves. Many boys in blue, especially from the border states, had volunteered to fight for the Union, not against slavery. Desertions increased sharply. The crucial congressional elections in the autumn of 1862 went heavily against the administration, particularly in New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. Democrats even carried Lincoln's Illinois, although they did not secure control of Congress. The Emancipation Proclamation caused an outcry to rise from the South that Lincoln the Fiend was trying to stir up the hellish passions of a slave insurrection. Aristocrats of Europe, noting that the proclamation applied only to rebel slaveholders, were inclined to sympathize with Southern protests. But the Old World working classes, especially in Britain, reacted otherwise. They sensed that the proclamation spelled the ultimate doom of slavery, and many laborers were more determined than ever to oppose intervention. Gradually the diplomatic position of the Union improved. The North now had much the stronger moral cause. In addition to preserving the Union, it had committed itself to freeing the slaves. the moral position of the South was correspondingly diminished. Blacks battled bondage as Lincoln moved to emancipate the slaves. He also took steps to enlist blacks in the armed forces. Although some African Americans had served in the Revolution and the War of 1812, the regular army contained no blacks at the war's outset, and the War Department refused to accept those free Northern blacks who tried to volunteer. The Union Navy, however, enrolled many blacks, mainly as cooks, stewards, and firemen. But as manpower ran low and emancipation was proclaimed, black enlistees were accepted, sometimes over ferocious protest from Northern as well as Southern whites. By wars and some 180,000 blacks served in the Union armies, most of them from the slave states, but many from the free soil North. Blacks accounted for about 10% of the total enlistments in the Union forces on land and sea and included two Massachusetts regiments raised largely through the efforts of the ex-slave Frederick Douglass. Black fighting men unquestionably had their hearts in the war against slavery that the Civil War had become after Lincoln proclaimed emancipation. Participating in about 500 engagements, they received 22 Congressional Medals of Honor, the highest military award. Their casualties were extremely heavy. More than 30,000 died, whether from battle, sickness, or reprisals from vengeful masters. Many, when captured, were put to death as slaves in revolt, for not until 1864 did the South recognize them as prisoners of war. In one notorious case, several black soldiers were massacred after they had formally surrendered at Fort Pillow, Tennessee. Thereafter, vengeful black units cried "Remember Fort Pillow" as they swung into battle and vowed to take no prisoners. For reasons of pride, prejudice, and principle, the Confederacy could not bring itself to enlist slaves until a month before the war ended, and then it was too late. Meanwhile, tens of thousands were forced into labor battalions, the building of fortifications, the supplying of armies, and other war-connected activities. Slaves, moreover, were the stomach of the Confederacy, for they kept the farms going while the white men fought. Ironically, the great mass of Southern slaves did little to help their Northern liberators, white or black. 1,000 scattered torches in the hands of 1,000 slaves would have brought the Southern soldiers home, and the war would have ended. Through the grapevine, the blacks learned of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. The bulk of them, whether because of fear, loyalty, lack of leadership, or strict policing, did not cast off their chains. But tens of thousands revolted with their feet when they abandoned their plantations upon the approach or arrival of Union armies, with or without emancipation proclamations. About 25,000 joined Sherman's march through Georgia in 1864, and their presence in such numbers created problems of supply and discipline. Lee's last lunge at Gettysburg after Antietam, Lincoln replaced McClellan as commander of the Army of the Potomac with General A.E. Burnside, whose ornate side whiskers came to be known as Burnside's or sideburns. Protesting his unfitness for this responsibility, Burnside proved it when he launched a rash frontal attack on Lee's strong position at Fredericksburg, Virginia, on December 13, 1862. "A chicken could not have lived in the line of fire," remarked one Confederate officer. More than 10,000 Northern soldiers were killed or wounded in Burnside's slaughter pen. A new slaughter pen was prepared when General Burnside yielded his command to Fighting Joe Hooker, an aggressive officer but a headstrong subordinate. At Chancellorsville, Virginia, May 4, 1863, Lee daringly divided his numerically inferior force and sent Stonewall Jackson to attack the Union flank. The strategy worked. Hooker, temporarily dazed by a near hit from a cannonball, was badly beaten but not crushed. This victory was probably Lee's most brilliant, but it was dearly bought. Jackson was mistakenly shot by his own men in the gathering dusk and died a few days later. "I have lost my right arm," lamented Lee. Southern folklore relates how Jackson outflanked the angels while galloping into heaven. Lee now prepared to follow up his stunning victory by invading the North again, this time through Pennsylvania. A decisive blow would add strength to the noisy peace plotters in the North and would also encourage foreign intervention still a Southern hope. 3 days before the battle was joined, Union General George G. Meade, scholarly, unspectacular, abrupt, was aroused from his sleep at 2 a.m. with the unwelcome news that he would replace Hooker. Quite by accident, Meade took his stand atop a low ridge flanking a shallow valley near quiet little Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, There is 92,000 men in blue locked in furious combat with at least 76,000 gray-clad warriors. The battle seesawed across the rolling green slopes for three agonizing days, July 1, 1863, and the outcome was in doubt until the very end. The failure of General George Pickett's magnificent but futile charge finally broke the back of the Confederate attack and broke the heart of the Confederate cause. Pickett's charge has been called the high tide of the Confederacy. It defined both the northernmost point reached by any significant Southern force and the last real chance for the Confederates to win the war. As the Battle of Gettysburg raged, a Confederate peace delegation was moving under a flag of truce toward the Union lines near Norfolk. Virginia Jefferson Davis hoped his negotiators would arrive in Washington from the south just as Lee's triumphant army marched on it from Gettysburg to the north. But the victory at Gettysburg belonged to Lincoln, who refused to allow the Confederate peace mission to pass through Union lines. From now on, the Southern cause was doomed. Yet the men of Dixie fought on for nearly 2 years longer, through sweat, blood, and weariness of spirit. Later in that dreary autumn of 1863, with the graves still fresh, Lincoln journeyed to Gettysburg to dedicate the cemetery. He read a 2-minute address, following a 2-hour speech by the orator of the day. Lincoln's noble remarks were branded by the London Times as ludicrous and by Democratic editors as dishwatery and silly. The address attracted relatively little attention at the time, but the president was speaking for the ages. The war in the West, events in the Western theater of the war at last provided Lincoln with an able general who did not have to be shelved after every reverse. Ulysses S. Grant had been a mediocre student at West Point, distinguishing himself only in horsemanship, although he did fairly well at mathematics. After fighting creditably in the Mexican War, he was stationed at isolated frontier posts, where boredom and loneliness drove him to drink. Resigning from the army to avoid a court-martial for drunkenness, he failed at various business ventures, and when war came, he was working in his father's leather store in Illinois for $50 a month. Grant did not cut much of the figure. The shy and silent shopkeeper was short, stooped, awkward, stubble-bearded, and sloppy in dress. He managed with some difficulty to secure a colonelcy in the volunteers. From then on, his military experience combined with his boldness, resourcefulness, and tenacity catapulted him on a meteoric rise. Grant's first signal success came in the Northern Tennessee Theater. After heavy fighting, he captured Fort Henry and Fort Donelson on the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers in February 1862. When the Confederate commander at Fort Donelson asked for terms, Grant bluntly demanded an unconditional and immediate surrender. Grant's triumph in Tennessee was crucial. It not only riveted Kentucky more securely to the Union but also opened the gateway to the strategically important region of Tennessee, as well as to Georgia and the heart of Dixie. Grant next attempted to exploit his victory by capturing the junction of the main Confederate North-South and East-West railroads in the Mississippi Valley at Corinth, Mississippi. But a Confederate force foiled his plans in the Quarry Battle at Shiloh, just over the Tennessee border from Corinth, on April 6-7, 1862. Though Grant successfully counterattacked, the impressive Confederate showing at Shiloh confirmed that there would be no quick end to the war in the West. Lincoln resisted all demands for the removal of unconditional surrender. Grant, insisting, "I can't spare this man. He fights." When talebearers later told Lincoln that Grant drank too much, the president allegedly replied, "Find me the brand, and I'll send a barrel to each of my other generals." There is no evidence that Grant's drinking habits seriously impaired his military performance. Other Union thrusts in the West were in the making. In the spring of 1862, a flotilla commanded by David G. Farragut joined with the Northern Army to strike the South a blow by seizing New Orleans. With Union gunboats both ascending and descending the Mississippi, the eastern part of the Confederacy was left with a jeopardized back door. Through this narrowing entrance, between Vicksburg, Mississippi, and Port Hudson, Louisiana, flowed herds of vitally needed cattle and other provisions from Louisiana and Texas. The fortress of Vicksburg, located on a hairpin turn of the Mississippi, was the South sentinel protecting the lifeline to the western sources of supply. General Grant was now given command of the Union forces attacking Vicksburg and in the teeth of grave difficulties displayed rare skill and daring. The siege of Vicksburg was his best fought campaign of the war. The beleaguered city at length surrendered, On July 4, 1863, with the garrison reduced to eating mules and rats. 5 days later came the fall of Port Hudson, the last southern bastion on the Mississippi. The spinal cord of the Confederacy was now severed, and, in Lincoln's quaint phrase, the father of waters at last flowed unvexed to the sea. The Union victory at Vicksburg July 4, 1863 came the day after the Confederate defeat at Gettysburg. The political significance of these back-to-back military successes was monumental. Reopening the Mississippi helped to quell the Northern peace agitation in the Butternut area of the Ohio River Valley. Confederate control of the Mississippi had cut off that region's usual trade routes down the Ohio-Mississippi River system to New Orleans, thus adding economic pain to that border section's already shaky support for the abolition war. The twin victories also conclusively tipped the diplomatic scales in favor of the North, as Britain stopped delivery of the Laird rams to the Confederates and as France killed a deal for the sale of 6 naval vessels to the Richmond government. By the end of 1863, all Confederate hopes for foreign help were irretrievably lost. Sherman scorches Georgia. General Grant, the victor of Vicksburg, was now transferred to the East Tennessee Theater, where Confederates had driven Union forces from the battlefield at Chickamauga into the city of Chattanooga, to which they then laid siege. Grant won a series of desperate engagements in November 1863 in the vicinity of besieged Chattanooga, including Missionary Ridge and Lookout Mountain, the Battle Above the Clouds. Chattanooga was liberated, the state was cleared of Confederates, and the way was thus open for an invasion of Georgia. Grant was rewarded by being made General-in-Chief. Georgia's conquest was entrusted to General William Tecumseh Sherman. Red-haired and red-booted, grim-faced and ruthless, he captured Atlanta in September 1864 and burned the city in November of that year. He then daringly left a supply base, lived off the country for some 250 miles, and weeks later emerged at Savannah on the sea. A rousing northern song marching through Georgia put it, "Sherman's dashing Yankee boys will never reach the coast." So the saucy rebels said, and it was a handsome boast. But Sherman's hated blue bellies, 60,000 strong, cut a 60-mile swath of destruction through Georgia. They burned buildings, leaving only the blackened chimneys, Sherman's sentinels. They tore up railroad rails, heated them red hot, and twisted them into iron donuts and Sherman's hairpins. They bayoneted family portraits and ran off with valuable souvenirs. "War is all hell," admitted Sherman later, and he proved it by his efforts to make Georgia hell. One of his major purposes was to destroy supplies destined for the Confederate Army and to weaken the morale of the men at the front by waging war on their homes. Sherman was a pioneer practitioner of total war. His success in Shermanizing the South was attested by increasing numbers of Confederate desertions. Although his methods were brutal, he probably shortened the struggle and hence saved lives. But there can be no doubt that the discipline of his army at times broke down, as roving riffraff Sherman's bombers engaged in an orgy of pillaging. Sherman the Brute was universally damned in the South. After seizing Savannah as a Christmas present for Lincoln, Sherman's army veered north into South Carolina, where the destruction was even more vicious. Many Union soldiers believed that the state, the hellhole of secession, had wantonly provoked the war. The capital city, Columbia, burst into flames, in all probability the handiwork of the Yankee invader. Crunching northward, Sherman's conquering army had rolled deep into North Carolina by the time the war ended. The politics of war presidential elections come by the calendar and not by the crisis. As fate would have it, the election of 1864 fell most inopportunely in the midst of war. Political infighting in the North added greatly to Lincoln's cup of woe. Factions within his own party, distrusting his ability or doubting his commitment to abolition, sought to tie his hands or even remove him from office. Conspicuous among his critics was a group led by the overambitious Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon Chase. Especially burdensome to Lincoln was the creation of the Congressional Committee on the Conduct of the War, formed in late 1861. It was dominated by radical Republicans who resented the expansion of presidential power in wartime and who pressed Lincoln zealously on emancipation. Most dangerous of all to the Union cause were the Northern Democrats. Deprived of the talent that had departed with the Southern wing of the party, those Democrats remaining in the North were left with the taint of association with the seceders. Tragedy befell the Democrats and the Union when their gifted leader, Stephen A. Douglas, died of typhoid fever 7 weeks after the war began. Unshakably devoted to the Union, he probably could have kept much of his following on the path of loyalty. Lacking a leader, the Democrats divided. A large group of war Democrats patriotically supported the Lincoln administration, but tens of thousands of peace Democrats did not. At the extreme were the so-called Copperheads, named for the poisonous snake, which strikes without a warning rattle. Copperheads openly obstructed the war through attacks against the draft, against Lincoln, and especially, after 1863, against emancipation. They denounced the president as the Illinoisan and condemned the Nigger War. They commanded considerable political strength in the southern parts of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. Notorious among the Copperheads was a sometime congressman from Ohio, Clement L. Vallandigham. This tempestuous character possessed brilliant oratorical gifts and unusual talents for stirring up trouble. A Southern partisan, he publicly demanded an end to the wicked and cruel war. The civil courts in Ohio were open, and he should have been tried in them for sedition. But he was convicted by a military tribunal in 1863 for treasonable utterances and was then sentenced to prison. Lincoln decided that if Vallandigham liked the Confederates so much, he ought to be banished to their lines. This was done. Vallandigham was not so easily silenced. Working his way to Canada, he ran for the governorship of Ohio on foreign soil and polled a substantial but insufficient vote. He returned to his own state before the war ended, and although he defied King Lincoln and spat upon the military decree, he was not further prosecuted. The strange case of Vallandigham inspired Edward Everett Hale to write his moving but fictional story of Philip Nolan, The Man Without a Country 1863, which was immensely popular in the North and which helped stimulate devotion to the Union. Nolan was a young army officer found guilty of participation in the Aaron Burr plot of 1806, see pages 223. He had cried out in court, "Damn the United States. I wish I may never hear of the United States again." For this outburst he was condemned to a life of eternal exile on American warships. The election of 1864. As the election of 1864 approached, Lincoln's precarious authority depended on his retaining Republican support while spiking the threat from the Peace Democrats and Copperheads. Fearing defeat, the Republican Party executed a clever maneuver. Joining with the War Democrats, it proclaimed itself to be the Union Party. Thus the Republican Party passed temporarily out of existence. Lincoln's renomination at first encountered surprisingly strong opposition. Hostile factions whipped up considerable agitation to shove homely old Abe in favor of his handsome nemesis, Secretary of the Treasury Chase. Lincoln was accused of lacking force, of being over ready to compromise, of not having won the war, and of having shocked many sensitive souls by his ill-timed and earthy jokes. "Prince of Jesters," one journal called him. But the ditch Lincoln move collapsed, and he was nominated by the Union Party without serious dissent. Lincoln's running mate was ex-tailor Andrew Johnson, a loyal war Democrat from Tennessee who had been a small slavey owner when the conflict began. He was placed on the Union Party ticket to sew up the election by attracting war Democrats and the voters in the border states, and, sadly, with no proper regard for the possibility that Lincoln might die in office. Southerners and Copperheads alike condemned both candidates as birds of a feather, too ignorant, third-rate, boorish, backwoods politicians born in log cabins. In that all Democrats regular and Copperhead nominated the deposed and overcautious war hero, General M.C. McClellan. The Copperheads managed to force into the Democratic platform a plank denouncing the prosecution of the war as a failure. But M.C. McClellan, who could not otherwise have faced his old comrades in arms, repudiated this defeatist declaration. The campaign was noisy and nasty. The Democrats cried, "Old Abe removed M.C. McClellan. We'll now remove old Abe." They also sang, "Mac will win the Union back." The Union Party supporters shouted for Uncle Abe and Andy and urged, "Vote as you shot." Their most effective slogan, growing out of a remark by Lincoln, was "Don't swap horses in the middle of the river." Lincoln's re-election was at first greatly in doubt. The war was going badly, and Lincoln himself gave way to despondency, fearing that political defeat was imminent. The anti-Lincoln Republicans, taking heart, started a new movement to dump Lincoln in favor of someone else. But the atmosphere of gloom was changed electrically, as balloting day neared, by a succession of northern victories. Admiral Farragut captured Mobile, Alabama, after defiantly shouting the now famous order, "Damn the torpedoes! Go ahead!" General Sherman seized Atlanta. General Little Phil Sheridan laid waste the verdant Shenandoah Valley of Virginia so thoroughly that in his words a crow could not fly over it without carrying his rations with him. The president pulled through, but nothing more than necessary was left to chance. At election time many northern soldiers were furloughed home to support Lincoln at the polls. One Pennsylvania veteran voted 49 times, once for himself and once for each absent member of his company. Other northern soldiers were permitted to cast their ballots at the front. Lincoln, bolstered by the bayonet vote, vanquished McClellan by 212 electoral votes to 21, losing only Kentucky, Delaware, and New Jersey. But Little Mac ran a closer race than the electoral count indicates. He netted a healthy 45% of the popular vote, 1,803,787 to Lincoln's 2,206,938, piling up much support in the southerner-infiltrated states of the Old Northwest, in New York, and also in his native state of Pennsylvania. See map on pages 470. One of the most crushing losses suffered by the South was the defeat of the Northern Democrats in 1864. The removal of Lincoln was the last ghost of a hope for a Confederate victory, and the Southern soldiers would wishfully shout, "Hurrah for McClellan!" When Lincoln triumphed, desertions from the sinking Southern ship increased sharply. Grant outlasted after Gettysburg. Grant was brought in from the West over Meade, who was blamed for failing to pursue the defeated but always dangerous Lee. Lincoln needed a general who, employing the superior resources of the North, would have the intestinal stamina to drive ever forward, regardless of casualties. A soldier of bold obstinacy, Grant was the man for this meat grinder type of warfare. His overall basic strategy was to assail the enemy's army simultaneously, so that they could not assist one another and hence could be destroyed piecemeal. His personal motto was, when in doubt, fight. Lincoln urged him to chew and choke, as much as possible. A grimly determined Grant, with more than 100,000 men, struck toward Richmond. He engaged Lee in a series of serious battles in the wilderness of Virginia, during May and June of 1864, notably in the leaden hurricane of the Bloody Angle and Hell's Half Acre. In this wilderness campaign, Grant suffered about 50,000 casualties, or nearly as many men as Lee commanded at the start. But Lee lost about as heavily in proportion. In a ghastly gamble, on June 3, 1864, Grant ordered a frontal assault on the impregnable position of Cold Harbor. The Union soldiers advanced to almost certain death with papers pinned on their backs bearing their names and addresses. In a few minutes, about 7,000 men were killed or wounded. Public opinion in the North was appalled by this blood and guts type of fighting. Critics cried that Grant the Butcher had gone insane. But his basic strategy of hammering had seemed brutally necessary. He could trade two men for one and still beat the enemy to its knees. "I propose to fight it out on this line," he wrote, "if it takes all summer." It did, and it also took all autumn, all winter, and a part of the spring. In February 1865 the Confederates, tasting the bitter dregs of defeat, tried desperately to negotiate for peace between the two countries. Lincoln himself met with Confederate representatives aboard a Union ship moored at Hampton Roads, Virginia, to discuss peace terms. But Lincoln could accept nothing short of Union and emancipation, and the Southerners could accept nothing short of independence. So the tribulation wore on amid smoke and agony to its terrible climax. The end came with dramatic suddenness. Rapidly advancing Northern troops captured Richmond and cornered Lee at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, in April 1865. Grant's double-bearded and informally dressed met with Lee on the 9th, Palm Sunday, and granted generous terms of surrender. Among other concessions, the hungry Confederates were allowed to keep their own horses for spring plowing. Tattered Southern veterans Lee's ragamuffins wept as they took leave of their beloved commander. The elated Union soldiers cheered, but they were silenced by Grant's stern admonition, "The war is over. The rebels are our countrymen again." Lincoln traveled to Concord, Richmond, and sat in Jefferson Davis's evacuated office just 40 hours after the Confederate president had left it. "Thank God I have lived to see this," he said. With a small escort of sailors, he walked the blasted streets of the city. Freed slaves began to recognize him, and crowds gathered to see and touch Father Abraham. One black man fell to his knees before the emancipator, who said to him, "Don't kneel to me. This is not right. You must kneel to God only, and thank him for the liberty you will enjoy hereafter." Sadly, as many freed slaves were to discover, the hereafter of their full liberty was a long time coming. The martyrdom of Lincoln on the night of April 14, 1865, Good Friday, only 5 days after Lee's surrender, Ford's Theater in Washington witnessed its most sensational drama. A half-crazed, fanatically pro-Southern actor, John Wilkes Booth, slipped behind Lincoln as he sat in his box and shot him in the head. After lying unconscious all night, the great emancipator died the following morning. "Now he belongs to the ages," remarked the once critical Secretary Stanton, probably the finest words he ever spoke. Lincoln expired in the arms of victory, at the very pinnacle of his fame. From the standpoint of his reputation, his death could not have been better timed if he had hired the assassin. A large number of his countrymen had not suspected his greatness, and many others had even doubted his ability. But his traumatic death helped to erase the memory of his shortcomings and caused his nobler qualities to stand out in clear relief. The full impact of Lincoln's death was not at once apparent to the South. Hundreds of bedraggled ex-Confederate soldiers cheered, as did some Southern civilians and Northern Copperheads, when they learned of the assassination. This reaction was only natural, because Lincoln had kept the war grinding on to the bitter end. If he had only been willing to stop the shooting, the South would have won. As time wore on, increasing numbers of Southerners perceived that Lincoln's death was a calamity for them. Belatedly, they recognized that his kindliness and moderation would have been the most effective shield between them and vindictive treatment by the victors. The assassination unfortunately increased the bitterness in the North, partly because of the fantastic rumor that Jefferson Davis had plotted it. A few historians have argued that Andrew Johnson, now president by bullet, was crucified in Lincoln's stead. The implication is that if the rail splitter had lived, he would have suffered Johnson's fate of being impeached by the embittered members of his own party who demanded harshness, not forbearance, toward the South. The crucifixion thesis does not stand up under scrutiny. Lincoln no doubt would have clashed with Congress. In fact, he had already found himself in some hot water. The legislative branch normally struggles to win back the power that has been wrested from it by the executive in time of crisis. But the sure-footed and experienced Lincoln could hardly have blundered into the same quicksands that engulfed Johnson. Lincoln was a victorious president, and there is no arguing with victory. In addition to his powers of leadership refined in the war crucible, Lincoln possessed in full measure tact, sweet reasonableness, and an uncommon amount of common sense. Andrew Johnson, hot-tempered and impetuous, lacked all of these priceless qualities. Ford's Theater, with its tragic murder of Lincoln, set the stage for the wrenching ordeal of Reconstruction. The aftermath of the nightmare of the Civil War took a grisly toll in gore, about as much as all of America's subsequent wars combined. Over 600,000 men died in action or of disease, and in all over a million were killed or seriously wounded. To its lasting hurt, the nation lost the cream of its young manhood and potential leadership. In addition, tens of thousands of babies went unborn because potential fathers were at the front. Direct monetary costs of the conflict totaled about $15 billion. But this colossal figure does not include continuing expenses, such as pensions and interest on the national debt. The intangible costs, dislocations, disunities, wasted energies, lowered ethics, blasted lives, bitter memories, and burning hates cannot be calculated. The greatest constitutional decision of the century, in a sense, was written in blood and handed down at Appomattox Courthouse, near which Lee surrendered. The extreme states' riders were crushed. The national government, tested in the fiery furnace of war, emerged unbroken. Nullification and secession, those twin nightmares of previous decades, were laid to rest. Beyond doubt, the Civil War, the nightmare of the Republic, was the supreme test of American democracy. It finally answered the question, in the words of Lincoln at Gettysburg, whether a nation dedicated to such principles can long endure. The preservation of democratic ideals, though not an officially announced war aim, was subconsciously one of the major objectives of the North. Victory for Union Arms also provided inspiration to the champions of democracy and liberalism the world over. The Great English Reform Bill of 1867, under which Britain became a true political democracy, was passed 2 years after the Civil War ended. American democracy had proved itself, and its success was an additional argument used by the disfranchised British masses in securing similar blessings for themselves. The lost cause of the South was lost, but few Americans today would argue that the result was not for the best. The shameful cancer of slavery was sliced away by the sword, and African Americans were at last in a position to claim their rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The nation was again united politically, though for many generations still divided spiritually by the passions of the war. Grave dangers were averted by a Union victory, including the indefinite prolongation of the peculiar institution, the unleashing of the slave power on weak Caribbean neighbors, and the transformation of the area from Panama to Hudson Bay into an armed camp, with several heavily armed and hostile states constantly snarling and sniping at one another. America still had a long way to go to make the promises of freedom a reality for all its citizens, black and white. But emancipation laid the necessary groundwork, and a united and democratic United States was free to fulfill its destiny as the dominant republic of the hemisphere and eventually of the world.